saving the world, one asteroid at a time, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Russ Durkee lives in Minnesota. His astronomical colleague, Alessandro Nastasi, is more than 8,000 kilometers or 5,000 miles away in Sicily. But that separation can't compare to the distance to the objects they study. These amateur astronomers spend nearly every clear night watching the skies for space rocks that cross our planet's path. They'll tell us about their work. We'll also welcome my colleague Ray Paletta in a couple of minutes. Ray has written an article reviewing the big questions we have about Venus and the spacecraft that may provide answers. We've always got a lot going on at the Planetary Society, including our free weekly newsletter called The Downlink. Here are a few headlines from the most recent edition. It's topped by a spectacular image of the eerie, overheated Venusian surface. Just below is a shot of Jupiter's moon Ganymede, grabbed barely a week ago by the Juno orbiter. We haven't seen pictures like this of our solar system's biggest moon since the Galileo mission more than two decades ago. You've probably heard by now that Jeff Bezos and his brother will be on board his Blue Origin New Shepard when it makes its first crewed suborbital flight. We don't yet know the identity of the person in the third seat, but we do know that she or he paid $28 million for the ride, and that's not including the 6% buyer's commission. No word yet regarding carry-on bag fees for the 11-minute flight. Want more? You'll find it at planetary.org/downlink. The long Venusian drought is over. Here's Planetary Society editor Ray Paletta. Ray, welcome back, and thank you for this June 9th article, Double Venus Missions, All the Burning Questions NASA Hopes to Answer. No pun intended, I'm sure. Double, it's now triple, right? Tell us about this new announcement from the European Space Agency.
Yeah, so we're actually getting not one, not two, but three missions to Venus, which is going to be super exciting. The third mission is actually called Envision. ESA just announced recently that they're going to be sending their own spacecraft to Venus, which is just incredible. I mean, it's been 30 years since NASA has sent a spacecraft to Venus. The last one, I believe, was Magellan. So it's kind of wild that everything is just turning up Venus.
Yeah, it's about time. 31 years since that launch of Magellan. It's just absolutely crazy that we've had to wait this long. We hope to have the principal investigators for both of the NASA missions on pretty soon. Maybe we can get the Envision equivalent of a PI as well. There are a lot of questions that we hope these missions are going to help us to answer, even if they don't provide full answers. You cover a lot of them in this article. One of them, we go back to that drought I mentioned at the top of this segment, water. There's all this speculation about did Venus, was it a much wetter place billions of years ago, like Mars? Is this going to help us with that?
Yeah, it's really incredible. I mean, when you think of something like Venus, it's hard to imagine that there was anything ever even just resembling an ocean on the planet, right? But yeah, there's actually a good chance that, hey, there might have been a watery past. So I think that with Da Vinci Plus, the spacecraft is actually going to drop a sphere through Venus's atmosphere and measure some of those noble gases that could be there. And that seems to be a big clue in finding out whether or not Venus ever had an ocean. Everything with these Venus questions is kind of interrelated. An ocean, plate tectonics, volcanoes. So I think that Da Vinci and Veritas together, which is the other NASA mission, they're going to tell us so much about whether or not there was ever an ocean on Venus. Or maybe, hey, is there still water on the planet? One idea is that Venus might have volcanoes that are spewing water out. So I guess we'll get a look into that as well.
Just crazy, wouldn't that be? I mean, cryovolcanoes in the outer solar system and water volcanoes on Venus. Very quickly, are these missions going to be able to help us with the great phosphine debate and the question about whether not just past life, but maybe current life in the atmosphere above the world?
Oh, yeah, it's incredible. I mean, it seems like Da Vinci Plus in particular is going to maybe be able to offer us some clarity here when it goes through Venus's atmosphere, like I said before. But both Da Vinci Plus and Veritas, it seems, are going to scope this out for us, right, in different ways. It's just so cool to see if, hey, are we going to get some new answers in this possible phosphine detection debate? What does that mean? Does that mean that Venus's clouds are maybe hiding some form of life? Obviously, that would be one of the biggest discoveries in the history of anything ever. But I yep. think that it'll be a good start to just see if Venus was ever once habitable.
And we have a good start. You know, sadly, it's going to be more than 10 years before these spacecraft reach their destination, second rock. But that is going to be a very exciting occurrence when they all go into orbit around Venus. Ray, thank you very much for joining me once again.
Always a pleasure, Matt. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Ray Paletta, my colleague at the Planetary Society, and I do recommend her June 9th article very highly, Double Venus Missions, and I won't be surprised if pretty soon we don't have something to say at planetary.org about Envision, that newly announced mission from the European Space Agency as well. Astronomer and planetary scientist Bruce Betts is the Planetary Society's chief scientist. Just one of his duties is management of the Shoemaker Near-Earth Object Grant Program. Of course, he's also the only other person heard on every episode of Planetary Radio since our premiere in 2002. Bruce, we get to talk to you up front once again. Of course, we're going to be back with What's Up toward the end of this week's show and a contest in which we will be awarding a really terrific, a just gorgeous book called Carbon, One Atom's Odyssey. Anyway, more about that later in the show. As you know, I talked with two of your Shoemaker Neo winners, Russ Durkee and Alessandro Nastasi. We're going to hear from them in moments, but there were a lot of other folks, right, who were awarded grants about a year and a half ago?
There were. There were six grant winners at that time, but we've given out 62 grants over the 20-plus years of the program for $500,000. So there are a lot of grant winners being represented by those two. Shoemaker Neo grants, Near-Earth Object grants, fund really advanced amateurs as well as professionals to upgrade their observatory facilities to mostly do tracking and characterizing of near-Earth objects to save the world.
Has it been as successful as anybody hoped? I mean, neither of us was around when this got started, I guess. Or were we?
Well, we were alive, and you may or may not have been. I was not. 97. It was started after the passing of Gene Shoemaker, the planetary scientist who did so much to teach us about the importance of impact in the solar system and impact on Earth. It's been more successful by far than I think anyone ever could have hoped, because it really fills a niche for this group that doesn't have obvious sources of funding, and they're able to take their observatories to the next level, whether it's, well, you'll hear about what these two have done, everything from cameras to re-illuminizing mirrors to automating things so that observatories can act robotically. So it's really, I mean, we have professionals telling us all the time how significant the impact of these amateurs and professionals that get Shoemaker Neo grants have been.
So we got a U.S. Midwesterner and a fellow in Sicily under the boot of Italy. They really have come from all over the world, haven't they?
We've awarded to, I believe, 19 countries and six continents. Antarctica, we're looking to you.
Accepting new Shoemaker Neo proposals right now, huh?
Yep, we've got a call for proposals out. You can go to planetary.org/neo-grants, N-E-O-grants, and learn more. But the deadline is July 28th of 2021. And if you've got an observatory and doing serious work involving near-Earth asteroids and looking for some help to upgrade your equipment, think about submitting a proposal.
I don't know if there's anything else that we need to say up front. We probably ought to hear from these two guys who have seen such benefits in their search, also characterization of near-Earth objects. But Bruce, as I said, we'll be back with you in a few minutes after we've heard from them. Thanks for joining me up front.
Most excellent. They're doing great work.
The first of the Shoemaker Neo grant recipients we'll talk with today received his third grant in late 2019. I called on Russell Durkee a few days ago for this report on his work, and about the opportunities it has provided for some of his high school students in Minnesota. Russ, welcome back to Planetary Radio, a year and a half after our first conversation, when you had just been awarded that Shoemaker-Neo grant, your third. So you are a multiple recipient. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Matt. Great to be back.
Shed of Science. I love it, but how did it get that name?
Well, I have to thank Bill Nye, actually.
Really?
Yeah, because I remember in college, I was in college when Bill Nye was doing his show on television, and we'd watch it every Saturday morning. I remember he had a bucket of science at some point in one of his shows, and I just thought that was awesome. And so when I was looking for observatory names, it was just a shed in my backyard. And so I said, well, this will now be the Shed of Science. And had I actually thought about it and knew that I would be still using it and trying to get grants and things like that using the name, I probably would have picked something a little more distinguished, but Shed of Science has worked out just fine. And that's where it came from, to be honest.
I love it. I know that the second of these three grants was also to allow you to buy a camera. We talked about that last time. And then something like 10 years passed and you picked up the camera that this current grant was able to get for you. How's it working out? Is it proving to be as valuable as you hoped?
Yeah, so far so good. It started off a little rough. You know, these cameras aren't things you can buy off the shelf. You order them from specialty manufacturers and they make them to order. And it arrived about 6 months after I made the purchase.
Wow.
And yeah, it's amazing the lead time. Then I installed it a month or two later, since my observatory is across the country for me. Then it proceeded to fail right after I drove across the country. And it took a month or so. The manufacturer was wonderful to work with. They fixed the camera, sent it back, and I had a colleague install it for me. And it was off to the races. And in fact, I ran it last night, and I'm looking at data as we speak.
So 9 or 10 months now where it's been working pretty reliably. What kind of improvement has it made for you? I mean, how dim an object could you really observe in the past? And what's the level now, the magnitude?
You know, I typically observe objects that are around 15th magnitude or so. Sometimes they're brighter. 14th magnitude is a little unusual. Before this, I was maybe observing objects down to 16th magnitude reliably with sufficient signal. But now I'm routinely going at least a magnitude and a half deeper. I've observed objects 17 and a half magnitude, and it allows me to operate at much cooler temperatures because the electronics are much more sensitive the cooler they operate. And so cooling is a big deal. And in Texas, where the observatory is located, it's not unusual for the temperature to be 90 degrees at sunset and 80 degrees at sunrise, or maybe even warmer at times.
Wow.
So that cooling is really important. And this camera is fantastic at it.
Tell me, where are you sitting right now?
I'm sitting in my basement one day after ending the school year. I'm a high school science teacher by trade. This is my first day of summer vacation, and I can tell you it never gets old. You still get that little thrill at the end of the school year.
I'm married to a former teacher, a retired teacher. I know how she felt about it. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I know that a big part of what you do has been involving students. You've been using your tracking of NEOs, your characterization of NEOs to help in your teaching, right? Because after all, you're a science teacher. You're still doing that? And how has that worked out during this awful year, a little more than a year, that we are hopefully coming to the end of?
Yeah, this was the toughest year I've ever had as a teacher. It started off online, and so we had a contingent of students eventually that were at school and some kids that were online. And I was online most of the year myself due to some health issues. It was extraordinarily difficult to teach science, which is really best done with labs and hands-on experiences in addition to the mathematics that you might have. And so it was hard on everybody, but especially the kids. We made it through. I've lost track of how many different schedules we've had and how many different groups of kids that were online at any given time, but we managed to get through it. I'm also lucky enough to teach an astronomy class. And in that class, we did a few virtual star parties, which was fun with the observatory. Kids were able to log on and see the telescope operating in real time. That inspired a couple of kids to try to do some work with me this year, but this wasn't the perfect year to do that. However, we do regularly have students that I work with on these projects. And I've had, in the last couple of years, we've had students that followed near-Earth asteroids. I've had students that tried to identify binary asteroids. And I was lucky enough to have a student even go to the International Science Fair as a result of working with the observatory. And so I'm ready to do that again next year. So it's just a great opportunity for kids.
I just wonder if you ever think about what some astronomers of the past, and in some cases the not so distant past, I mean, you know, people like Edwin Hubble and Fritz Zwicky, a little bit further back, Annie Jump Cannon, there are so many, what they would have given to have a digital camera like this instead of old photographic plates.
Oh, I can't imagine. I think about that every now and then because of the limited time that's available under a clear sky with a resource like this. I think about what should I be doing with this equipment right now to get the most bang for the buck? And then I worry about, well, am I actually doing what needs to be done? Is this the best use of my resource? And I wish I could speak to those people and say, what am I missing? What really should I be doing with this? Because they would really know, right? There's like, why are you not taking spectra right now? Or why are you not, you know, what? Maybe there's something even more important than NEOs, but I can't think of it at the moment. But yeah, I think about that because it's an embarrassment of riches, isn't it? To be able to connect to something that is reasonably reliable 1,500 miles away and make it do my bidding. And it's crazy. It's an amazing time.
Golden age of astronomy. And Russ, thank you for being part of it. Congratulations once again on the great work that you're doing, and just keep it up. And I won't be surprised if we have reason to talk again sometime before too long.
Yeah, I hope so. Keep up the good work and thanks for the support.
Amateur astronomer and Shoemaker NEO grant recipient Russ Durkee. We're a minute away from a trip to Sicily that will also take us to the asteroid belt and beyond. This is Planetary Radio.
Bill Nye, the planetary guy here. The threat of a deadly asteroid impact is real. The answer to avoiding it? Science. And you. It's the only large-scale natural disaster that could one day be prevented. The Society is getting ready to award its next round of Shoemaker Near-Earth Object Grants to talented astronomers around the world. You can learn more about this opportunity and our other work at planetary.org/NEO. We're just trying to save the world.
Hey, Planetary Radio listeners, the Planetary Society now has an official online store. We've teamed up with Chop Shop, known for their space mission posters, to bring you space-inspired art and merchandise. You can find exclusive Planetary Society t-shirts, posters, and more. Visit planetly/spaceshop to learn more. That's planet.ly/spaceshop.
We're back for a brief visit with the second of our recent Shoemaker NEO grant recipients. Alessandro Anastasi wants you to visit the Gal Hassin Observatory in Sicily. He was there when we talked last week. Sicily may not be the first place that people think of for astronomy, but there is some great history there. I remember you saying that Ceres was discovered not far from your location.
Correct. Ceres, the first asteroid, the number one, was discovered actually in Palermo, which is less than 100 kilometers from here, by the astronomer Piazzi, a man working for church, and he was working at the Observatory of Palermo. Yes.
Number one and still the biggest in the asteroid belt. Yeah, pretty impressive achievement there. It is such a gorgeous location. It's like a park, almost an amusement park for astronomy.
Correct, Matt. We actually sit in a very nice landscape because our astronomical center is surrounded by some mountains, which actually helps to preserve the dark sky because block the light pollution from, for example, from the seaside or from the south. So we have a very dark south sky. Also, since we are in Sicily, as you say, in very south part of Europe, we have access to the galactic center, which is a very interesting target to observe.
There's something else that you showed us. It's a beautiful little dome, which I take it is pretty new. Inside is one of your telescopes, this 0.4 meter or 40 centimeter telescope. That dome is one of the results of this grant, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. It's brand new because it's a 3 meter scope dome that we purchased thanks to the funding of the Schumacher New Grant in 2019. This allowed us to actually move the telescope you mentioned. We call the Galassine Robotic Telescope 1, so GRT-1, outside the, let's say, the area where I walk, which is nice, but actually which is mainly devoted to outreach and activity with public. So, since you have to open the entire hangar, it takes time and you're not promptly active to observe the sky. Within this dome, actually, we take just 7 minutes to turn on the telescope, the camera, open the shutter of the dome and point the target. So the dome and also the timekeeping system really helped us in getting more efficient and faster and more effective, okay, in monitoring the news, the fastest and the most interesting targets.
Fantastic work, Alessandro. Once again, congratulations to you and the entire team there, your colleagues at Galassine. Thank you and keep up the great work. Clear skies.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you. Clear sky to everyone. And hope to see you all at the Galassine. So I wish really to see you all. You're visiting us. So thank you again.
Alessandro provides a terrific video tour of Galassine that you can enjoy on this week's episode page at planetary.org/radio. That's also where you can hear much more of my conversations with both Alessandro and Russ Durkee. As promised, it's time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Here again is the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, Bruce Betts. Welcome once again.
Good to be back, Matt. It's been so long.
Yeah, simply many, many, many milliseconds since you last visited. What's up there in the night sky?
Well, in the evening sky over in the west, soon after sunset, you've got super bright Venus, very easy to see. If you've got a clear view to the western horizon, it will keep getting higher in the sky over the coming weeks. And much dimmer, reddish Mars is up above that. And they will be growing closer and closer until they have a mid-July snuggle in the west. In the pre-dawn, or even rising around the middle of the night in the east, is bright Jupiter, and to its right, yellowish Saturn. All right, we move on to this week in space history. 1963, Valentina Tereshkova became the first woman in space. Oddly, it would be another almost 20 years before the second woman in space, but now they're flying all the time. Yay. Hard to believe it was 2004. Spaceship One became the first privately funded human to space mission.
Wait, that's right. I'm getting so old. That was the one I was standing on the tarmac. Holy cow.
That was amazing because you were still in elementary school.
Yeah. I was very lucky that that my uncle brought me out. No, I was actually doing it for this show.
Yeah.
Even more incredibly. Yeah.
Yeah. You can go back in the archives and listen. All right. We move on to Random Space Fun.
I don't know what Bill's Science Rules audience is going to make of that. But yeah, we do this pretty much every week, although he does it differently every week, folks.
It's amazing and probably annoying. And for that, I apologize. But I've got a good random space fact to make up for it. We've talked about how enormous the sun is compared to the Earth. You can fit a million Earths inside the sun. But let's talk about the star Betelgeuse in Orion. Mm. It is so big.
How big is it?
It is so big that you...
How big is it? I can't resist the cue line. You know, it's like that scene in Roger Rabbit. Shave and a haircut.
It is so big that you could fit a billion suns inside Betelgeuse. And so let me give you an analogy for this impossible to imagine. Oh, wait, it's not impossible to imagine. If you go to the Rose Bowl near me or any very large stadium, and imagine that as the size of Betelgeuse, then the sun would be about the size of a soccer ball. And the Earth would be about the size of a tomato seed hanging out on your burger at the game.
I love the universe.
And it loves you, Matt.
I'm glad. It's the best of all possible universes.
It is indeed. And that reminds me, we have a trivia contest. I don't know why that reminds me of that. So I asked you, as of now, June 2021, how many of the 9 spacecraft that have visited Jupiter are still communicating with Earth? How do we do, Matt?
I know why it reminded you, because these are the only spacecraft that are headed out across that universe. Well, one of them is not, come to think of it. Here is the answer from our poet laureate. Yes, we have a poet laureate, Dave Fairchild in Kansas. 9 robotic spacecraft have gone by the planet King. 5 of them are off the grid. A disappointing thing. The Voyagers are still alive, and New Horizons too, while Juno keeps in contact from its polar point of view. 4 spacecraft, right?
Yes, indeed. Voyagers 1 and 2, New Horizons, and in orbit around Jupiter, Juno.
Here is our winner, Perry Metzger in New Hampshire. And here's what's interesting. Perry won exactly 365 days ago. That's including the leap day in the year 2020. We do have repeat performances here, everybody. Perry, congratulations. You're going to get a Planetary Radio t-shirt that can be checked out in the Planetary Society store at chopshopstore.com. Thanks for staying in the game, Perry.
Congratulations.
We're ready for another one. Maybe we'll get some more sci-fi next time.
First, a little background. Betelgeuse, that we talked about, despite being 500 light years away-ish, is actually the 3rd widest star as seen from Earth, the 3rd largest angular diameter. And of course, the Sun is first. Here's your trivia question. After the Sun, what star has the largest angular diameter as seen from Earth? Go to planetary.org/radio contest. So what's the widest looking star when you look out from Earth that's not the Sun?
You have until June 23rd at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us the answer for this one. And you will be in the running, and could win if random.org picks your correct answer, for this beautiful book that I mentioned up front, Carbon, One Atom's Odyssey, lovingly and exquisitely illustrated by John Barnett, with a foreword by Roald Hoffman, the recent Nobel laureate in chemistry. It's basically the life story from the beginning of our universe of a carbon molecule, or a carbon atom, I guess. It is absolutely gorgeous. It's published by No Starch Press, by the way, and we'll put up a link on this week's show page of planetary.org/radio, where you can also enter the contest. Bruce, we're done.
Holy moly. All right, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about tomatoes in space. Thank you, and good night.
How many tomatoes are in a mole?
6.02 times 10 to the 23rd.
Boy, that's a lot of ketchup. You can make a lot of mole. He's Bruce Betts, the chief scientist and sometimes chemist of the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by our more than 50,000 members. Editorial Director Jason Davis is filling in as our associate producer this week. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Thanks, and that Astro Bill.